ready?
Yep.
3, 2, 1. Welcome to the Jesus Name News Podcast. I'm Derek. I got Larry here with me. This week, we're going to continue our series on men of integrity, looking at the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego at the fiery furnace. We'll also get into some math, and look, I know we don't really all like math that much, but stick around with us. We'll be back right after the break.
Listen, you know, we have a new podcast out called That Pentecostal Podcast. Episodes are already available. So, Larry, why don't you tell us a little bit more about what's happening over at TPP?
Yeah, we saw a need for a devotional podcast in the Pentecostal realm. We saw a need just for a short, uplifting moment that we can give to people. And so we decided that we're going to do it. We're going to make one. We're going to put it out there. It's going to include us. It's going to include our new members of the team. It's going to have Derek. It's going to have me. It's going to have Adrian. It's going to have some other people. We're going to have guests. And we're going to bring to you life applicable, faith building, Holy Ghost fire devotionals every single Monday.
That Pentecostal Podcast is available everywhere you get your podcast. So go set it to download, set it to notify you, whatever you need to do. But don't miss That Pentecostal Podcast every Monday.
Welcome back to the Jesus Name News Podcast. We've been talking about men of integrity the last few weeks and focusing on the story in the book of Daniel. We've discussed history, we've talked about the Daniel's fast, and now we've come to chapter 3 of Daniel. Let's open up the Word and let's take a look at this story. Derek, if you could start us off by reading Daniel chapter 3, verses 1 through 7.
King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all of the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justice magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and they stood before the image of Nebuchadnezzar that he had set up, and the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whosoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace." Therefore, as soon as the peoples all heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up.
So, Nebuchadnezzar built this massive gold statue, this image. 60 cubits is about 90 feet. To give some perspective, Solomon's temple was only 30 cubits high. Now, that was an entire building with multiple rooms, whereas this was just a statue of Nebuchadnezzar. However, the statue was ridiculous. The statue was, you know, 9 stories tall.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's...
like,
that's almost unheard of, but I would think that it's kind of on par with maybe what some of the Greeks had done. I'd have to look that up, but
yeah, like the that one statue that was on that cliff,
Atlas.
Yeah, I know it doesn't exist anymore, but we know it existed at some point. Stuff like that. I mean, it wasn't out of the question, but it was ridiculous. And so he gathered everybody together. Now remember, this gathering together, it would have theoretically included the 4 Hebrew men. I mean, I feel like everybody still calls them boys, but I mean, at this time, they've definitely become men.
Oh, yeah.
And they would have been there. Now, Daniel is not mentioned in this story. He could have been off on some task. He could have been exempt somehow. We don't know. But we do know that Daniel is not mentioned in this story only the other three. And Nebuchadnezzar tells everyone to worship the image when the music starts, or they will be executed by being thrown into a fiery furnace. And this is the thing. I read this and it makes me think of another story where this same kind of threat is used. If you could read Revelation 13, 15 through 17.
And it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast so that the image of the beast might even speak and might cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain. Also, it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark that is the name of the beast of the number thereof.
Here's the thing. The play here is fear. Nebuchadnezzar's game plan is fear. It's fear and peer pressure, which ultimately is fear of not fitting in, being rejected, fearing execution. You know, in the book of Revelation, starvation on top of execution. Even if somehow you escape being killed for not worshiping the beast, you're then not going to be able to buy or sell anything. Ultimately, that fear, that threat, is a means to the end of forcing compliance. And so let's see how this plays out. If we read Daniel 3:8.
It says, therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews.
So here's the thing. They accused them, but they didn't just do it because it was the right thing to do. They did it because they did it out of malice. They did it out of dislike. They did it to target them. Maybe that's why Daniel wasn't part of this, because he was already elevated enough that they knew they couldn't touch him for this.
Yeah.
Whereas these three, they were still vulnerable. So from there, the Chaldeans literally repeat Nebuchadnezzar's decree that we just read for verses 9 through 11. And then they get to the point of their accusation in Daniel 3:12.
It says, there are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up.
Here's the thing. Maybe these guys were true believers. Maybe they really worshiped Nebuchadnezzar and they really believed that he was the king of kings and the true master of all creation. And maybe they didn't. We don't know. We don't know. Other than that, there was some malice behind their accusation, it doesn't really tell us what these people thought. It could have all just been a show and a power play. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they weren't out there being obnoxious. They were just doing their thing, and they didn't bow. They didn't worship the image. They weren't necessarily making spectacles of themselves either. It's not like they were going around shouting at everybody and demanding that no one worship the image. At least not from what the text tells us.
No, I mean, it doesn't feel like they're drawing attention to themselves. Otherwise, this would have happened without malicious intent. It reminds me, which I know this is before the lion's den and Cyrus and all that.
Yeah.
It does remind me a lot of, you know, the king being like, oh, well, this is my decree. And then they're like, well, Daniel's not doing that. So there's an obvious pattern here that I believe Daniel was trying to set up. Like, they are constantly not trying to draw attention to themselves. And then when they're just simply obeying what their God tells them to do.
Yeah.
That's when the enemy comes in and they try to, you know, get them for doing what their God told them to do and not bowing and not worshiping and all those things.
Yeah, and I guess the reason you mention that is that ultimately, if you're going to claim persecution, you can't demand persecution. You know, like you can't start a fight and then complain that there was a fight.
Yeah, I mean, you can't grab a hold of someone's arm and be like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
And they're telling you, you better stop. And then all of a sudden their right hand comes out of nowhere and pops you right in the face. I mean, you can't be surprised.
Exactly.
Right? You don't get to cry persecution when you're going around saying, I'm being persecuted, or look at me, I'm not bowing to that, or whatever. Like, you don't need to do that.
If you're in somebody's face and you're insulting them and they punch you in the face, you can't say that you're the victim. I mean, maybe they were wrong. Yeah, sure, violence is not the answer. I get that. But, like, you're not innocent in that moment. But these three, they were just doing the right thing. They were just doing what they believed to be right. And the thing is that Nebuchadnezzar didn't notice. If it wasn't for these people maliciously bringing them in front of Nebuchadnezzar, he wouldn't have noticed. But here's the thing. Nebuchadnezzar himself is manipulated by these malicious accusations. If we read Daniel 3:13-15.
Then Nebuchadnezzar in furious rage commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast in the burning fiery furnace. And who is the God that will deliver you out of my hand?
So here's the thing. Nebuchadnezzar, again, is relying on one of two things here. He's relying on people who either truly believe in what he's saying to obey and exert pressure on other people, or people who are willing to manipulate what he's using against those who don't obey what he says. And then he's using the fear of execution in the fiery furnace and the betrayal of the neighbors to go after them. Really, there's no other reason given to worship the image. It's not like he's not even promising a blessing. This isn't a prosperity thing where if you worship the image, I will bless you. He's not saying any of that. He's just saying, do this or die.
Yeah, I mean,
it's all fear.
It really does feel like I've never thought about it. I've probably heard it preached, but I've never thought about how similar it does sound to the mark of the beast in a way, which that's not the only parallel. We'll talk about it, but
yeah.
It's not the only parallel between Revelations and
Daniel.
Daniel.
And the thing is that it's like there's this meme that I see every once in a while where it's that image of Jesus knocking on the door, and it's very anti-Christian, so I'm not encouraging this at all. But he's like, let me in so I can save you. And the person replies, from what? And he's like, I want to save you from me, for what happens if you don't listen to me? And it's like, people share this meme and they act like God is just wanting to punish us. But the thing is that the reality of what happens when we reject God isn't God's purpose. God's purpose is the blessing that he actually intends us to have. But what we see is when evil things do a similar ploy, they don't promise anything. Nebuchadnezzar is not making a promise. The Antichrist, when he demands worship of the beast and demands the mark of the beast be taken, there's nothing in there that's implying there's any promise involved with following. The only thing that's promised is that they will punish you if you don't do it. And that's the difference between a warning and a threat. Hell is a warning. God is warning us the end result of our disobedience and sin, and providing us a way out of that reality to something better. Nebuchadnezzar is threatening. The Antichrist is threatening, okay? And the thing is that they're playing on fear because fear is so powerful. There's a story I know of a famous thief from the Wild West. His name was Black Bart. Black Bart for 8 years terrorized Wells Fargo, which, not Wells Fargo the bank, although it is the same company, Wells Fargo the wagon delivery company, or whatever they were doing. I think it was wagons, stagecoaches, right? Over those 8 years, Black Bart robbed 29 stagecoaches. This is the crazy thing about it, though. He never fired a shot, never shot anybody. He never took a hostage. He was successful 29 times. But even beyond not taking a hostage and not firing a shot, Black Bart was afraid of horses. He didn't ride horses. And he didn't really have a gang either. He did most of these robberies either on his own or with a very small crew. What Black Bart did was he relied on fear to paralyze his victims and manipulate them into giving him what he wants, even though the thing he was telling them they should be afraid of didn't exist at all. It's like the stories of somebody robbing a bank with a water gun, only he did it 30 times over 8 years and nobody caught on to it. When he was finally caught, he wasn't caught because he failed in a robbery. It was because, like, somebody noticed a cloth he used as a mask or something and notified the authorities and they figured out it was him. He never failed a stagecoach robbery. The thing is that this kind of fear, it's defined as one of two things. It's a distressing emotion aroused by impending danger, evil, or pain, whether the target is real or imagined. Or it's a specific instance or propensity for such a feeling, a phobia. A phobia is a persistent irrational fear. Nebuchadnezzar is hoping that he can use this fear of death, which is a distressing emotion caused by actual impending bad and pain and something that we worry about. It is human to fear death on some level. That's not an irrational thing to have some concern about that. He was relying on that rational, normal emotion to become irrational and cause people to obey him, even when they knew that it wasn't the best thing for them. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego give a great response, okay? This is probably my favorite verse in the whole Bible, right here. If you could read Daniel 3:16-18...
Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up.
So I want to read this in another version. We use the ESV almost always here. I'm not big on using this version of the Bible, however, for deep study. But this passage, I love it, okay? We're going to read out of the Message, Daniel 3:16-18. I'm going to read it real quick. It says, your threat means nothing to us. If you throw us in the fire, the God we serve can rescue us from your roaring furnace and anything else you might cook up, O king. But even if he doesn't, it wouldn't make a bit of difference, O king. We still wouldn't worship your gods or worship the gold statue you set up. These three men, they knew what they were standing for. They knew what they were doing. They were not going to back down because they weren't afraid of dying for what they believed in. They weren't afraid of dying for what was right. Nebuchadnezzar is enraged by this. He was already angry at the manipulation of the malicious enemies of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But now it's worse because they were not afraid of his threats, and that fear was his only play. So here, they overcome the problem they face by understanding that God can save them, but admitting that even if he doesn't, they're willing to die rather than disobey God. So let's read what happens when Nebuchadnezzar commands the furnace to be heated 7 times above its normal heat. They're bound in their clothes and thrown in the fire. It's so hot, the men who threw them in the furnace are killed by the fury of the fire in the furnace. And Daniel 3:24-30 says, if you could read that, Derek.
Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire? They answered and said to the king, true, O king. He answered and said, but I see 4 men unbound, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt, and the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods. Then Nebuchadnezzar came near the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire. And the satraps and the prefects and the governors and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of these men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their clothes were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants, who trusted in him, and set aside the king's command, and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Therefore I make a decree, any people, nation, or language that speaks against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, and their house laid in ruins, for there is no other God who was able to rescue in this way." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon.
They stood strong. They held to their faith in the light of the attempt of the world to overcome them by fear, and God blessed them and took them through it. So how did they do it? Well, I have, and we're going to call it a proof because we've reached the portion of the episodes where we're going to talk about math, and I promise it's not that deep. It's really good, okay? But we're going to call this a proof to explain it. The proof is this. Fear plays on the irrational part of our mind. Fear is, when fear takes hold, it's irrational, okay? There is a level of fear that is rational and just understanding that we want to avoid things that hurt. But the kind of fear that you can use to get people to go against their beliefs, go against the things they know to be true, to betray themselves, their God, their family, that fear is irrational. Okay? He wanted to play on that irrational fear that he was trying to create in them. In mathematics, there's a constant. The constant is represented by the symbol I. Okay? This constant signifies that a number is irrational. All that means is that it's the square root of negative 1. Okay? Now, if you know math, a negative number times a negative number is a positive number. So there's no way for a negative 1 to be the result of a multiplication problem when something is multiplied by itself, which means that the square root of negative 1 is impossible to exist. It cannot exist, okay? Hence, it is irrational. It doesn't exist. It's impossible to exist. So the square root of any negative number that is needed, what you do, if you need the square root of negative 25, you get 5 and then I, or the square root of negative 1, because you have to just remove that out and then figure out everything else without it. So, how does one make an irrational number rational? Rational in mathematical sense means a real thing. It means real. It means it exists. Simple. We multiply by I. Because the solution to a number being irrational is to multiply it by an irrational number. I times I equals 1. When you apply irrational to the irrational, it becomes whole. So the solution to our irrational fear is faith, because faith can be equally irrational. If you want to read Hebrews 11:1.
Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for and the conviction of things not seen.
Faith is the assurance of our hope. It's the conviction, the surety of things that we can't see. That sounds pretty irrational. Being assured of things that you only hope for. Being convicted of things that you can't see that they exist. The thing is that irrational doesn't mean false. Being afraid of a grizzly bear that is full speed running at you is valid. And it's something you should fear on some level. But if that fear is so big and it's so massive and it becomes irrational and it makes you freeze and stop functioning, you can't solve the problem of what to do about that charging, raging grizzly bear. You have to overcome it. So here's the thing. To have faith in the face of fear, we can't just know that God will get us through it. Peter, Paul, and the other apostles that faced death, that were martyred for the kingdom of God, they didn't just have faith that God was going to heal them and free them and save them. They had faith that said, I don't care. They had faith that said, though he slay me, yet will I serve him. They had faith that says, it doesn't matter what happens. Jesus had that faith when he died on the cross, and he calls us to that same kind of faith. He died on the cross for the sins of every man that would ever live, knowing that most of them would never accept the sacrifice he was making, but he still died for them. Peter was crucified upside down. How? Because he had faith. He still had faith in that, because he wasn't going to betray his faith. He wasn't going to betray what he knew was true. He wasn't going to betray what was, because he was afraid of dying. No, he stood up and he accepted it. Paul was martyred. Stephen was martyred. James, Andrew, the rest, they were martyred. They died for their faith. They died in faith. Their faith didn't fail because God didn't magically make everything rosy and prosperous and amazing. Their faith said that even if they died, they still believed. They trusted God in death. We need that kind of faith. We need the faith that says, I don't care if I die for my faith in God. We need the faith that says, I don't care if I'm a social pariah. I don't care what happens. I'm not going to stop praying. I'm never going to bow to your gods. I'm never going to go against what I know is true. The kind of faith that loves the lost even when it hurts. That's the kind of faith that moves mountains. That's the kind of faith that brings revivals. That's the faith that raises the dead, heals the sick, and turns the world upside down. That faith allows us to love those who persecute us, to care for those who hurt us, to pray for those who are martyring us. Stephen was getting stoned, and he looked to the heavens, and he saw Jesus, and he asked for those men that were killing him to be forgiven. This ultimately is a story of faith, and the only way that we can stand up to fear in our world is faith.
If you look throughout the whole Old Testament, going back to Abraham, leaving your homeland at the age of 75 is irrational, at best, and thinking that you're going to have a baby with your 90-year-old wife is irrational at best.
Yeah, there's a reason she laughed, and it always makes me, I'm always confused when people act like she's being ridiculous to laugh at the notion of her having a baby. Like, I get that that was a theophany, but like, I don't know if they really realized it was a theophany yet at that point. And like, she's 90. If somebody tells a 90-year-old woman you're going to have a baby, like, I don't see how you don't laugh.
The stories that we value all have an irrational kind of faith.
Yeah.
The stories that built whole religions have irrational faith. And again, when we say irrational, we're not speaking badly. We're speaking in a sense that it doesn't make sense to the people around us. It doesn't make sense to us.
Yeah.
The kind of faith that we're constantly trying to talk about and constantly trying to get people to understand is, look, there's times where you're going to have to trust God and lean not on your own understanding. I mean, that's a proverb. But the problem is, in this generation, with artificial intelligence, with Google, with everything at your hands, irrationality doesn't really make sense to us.
Yeah, you can't spreadsheet it.
You can't, you can't spreadsheet irrationality. You can't make sense out of irrationality.
You can't grind your level up.
And then people say, okay, well, they said the Mark of the Beast was a barcode back in the 70s. They said the Mark of the Beast was a chip in the 1990s. They said the Mark of the Beast was, well, no, 70s was Visa or MasterCard.
It was like it went from credit cards to barcodes to microchips to RF chips to, I mean, none of that's even needed anymore.
But that's not the point. I'm saying what we need to understand is that having that healthy fear of like what might be coming is good.
Yeah.
People say, well, the saying those things are going to be the mark of the beast is silly. Fair. You know, looking back on it with 2020 vision, fair. Why doesn't it make it more true? Because if each generation is able to say, watch out for this, watch out for this, watch out for this, like, whether it's bad or not, they're constantly trying to keeping that truth alive. down each generation.
Yeah.
It's the same reason that God told Israel, hey, you're going to have a Passover in the first month. I believe it was Nisan. You're going to do this during this month to remember how, what I did for you coming out of, you know, Egypt. I view it that way. Now, people today say it's irrational to believe that God is going to come back. Maybe he's even already come back. You know, there are people who believe 70 AD was the return. And to those people, I'm like, well, there are a lot of things right now that have not been done since Jesus was nailed to a cross and resurrected. There's been a lot of things that are prophesied in the Bible that have not been fulfilled. And the other part of that is people go, okay, well, I don't understand why we have to be afraid of, or afraid is a wrong word, but afraid of the devil. I don't understand why we have to be afraid of sinning and not doing the right things. Again, you can search the world over, but there's not going to be a life outside of Christ that is better than this. You're not going to find a more moral life. You're not going to find a more true life. You're not going to find a more meaningful life. And I understand that there's stories out there, well, I got out of religion. I got out of Pentecost. I got out of, you know, take your pick, for God's sake. Just take your pick, right? Because we all have stories. People say all those things. Do you still go to McDonald's? Do you still go to Wendy's? Do you still, like, they screw up your order 5 times out of 10.
Yeah.
And you're still going to go back. You know, just because something did wrong on one side doesn't mean that the whole thing is bad. Just because, and it's kind of like the I times I thing. Whatever someone did bad, God is still good, which makes it real and rational. It doesn't matter. Like, yes, people can give God a bad name. Yes, people can give Christianity a bad name. But the truth is that it doesn't matter what people do because God is still good. It doesn't matter how bad people try to make him look because God is still good.
Yeah.
That is the truth, whether we like it or not.
Yeah, and ultimately that faith is the only thing that can really truly overcome that fear and eliminate it. When you truly have faith in God, you're not afraid of death. You're not afraid of what might happen. You're not afraid of losing your life for the gospel. You know, the answer to that fear that we have, it's faith. It isn't guns. It isn't government. It isn't vaccines or medicine. And here's the thing. Guns can be good. Government can be good. Medicine is good. Vaccines have done lots of good. Okay? So none of those things are inherently bad. But ultimately, when you're trusting in those things, that fear, it still exists. Those are things that kind of cover up the fear a little bit. Those are things that allow you to pretend like the fear isn't there, but it's still there. What I'm saying is that when you have faith in God, when that metaphorical angry grizzly bear of the world is chasing you down, you don't care anymore. That's faith. Faith is saying, God is going to save me. And even if he doesn't, then I just get to go home early. And that's fine. And that is faith.
Yeah. To be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord.
Yeah, because we live in a world that everyone is trying to use fear to control people. Fear is everywhere. Everybody is anxious. Everybody is full of fear. Everyone is concerned about the future. Everybody has all of these worries. In the face of that fear that is always trying to be used to control us, we have to stand like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did. Because when we stand in faith that says, though he slay me, though God doesn't save me, though I am persecuted, though I suffer for the name's sake, I will still stand for what is right. I will still help the hurting. I will still love those who hate me, and I will still do right. Because in the end, if God doesn't save me, I just get to spend eternity with him still. Our rational faith, it flies in the face of the reality of fear that the world is presenting. And that is what we need to trust in.
OK, Catch us every Wednesday wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us also at That Pentecostal Podcast that comes out every Monday everywhere you get your podcasts. We're going to keep trying to make content for you guys. We're going to keep trying to do some different things. There's a few really interesting projects that we got in the works that we can't wait to share with you later on this year. Be looking out for that, and we'll see you guys next week.